From 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR, this is Lake Effect. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Today, we dig into a report about why the state has so few black and brown teachers and possible solutions. While many businesses have struggled through the pandemic, we'll hear from someone who actually started a business last year.
I can't believe that I was able to start a business in the middle of a year that could have been the very worst year for me.
Then we hear from a filmmaker who documented the women of Standing Rock working to protect their land and water.
Women are the ones who are the guardians and the protectors of the water, and it's their duty to be the ones to lead the charge.
Plus, we'll look at the importance of women in music with one of the presenters at this year's River West Femme Fest. Lake Effect is next, but first the news. This is Lake Effect from 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Thanks for joining us. Students in Wisconsin's K-12 schools are rapidly becoming more diverse, but their teachers are not. 95% of Wisconsin teachers are white, compared to about 70% of students. It's an important imbalance, partly because research shows that students of color benefit from having at least one teacher who looks like them. The Wisconsin Policy Forum is digging into why the state has so few black and brown teachers and possible solutions. Policy Forum senior researcher Ann Chapman answered those questions through data and interviews with educators. WUWM education reporter Emily Files talked to Chapman about her new report, which explores the barriers to teacher diversity in Wisconsin.
We framed this as a teacher pipeline problem. So we looked at barriers and we sort of categorized them at three main junctures in the teacher pipeline. There's more than what we looked at, but we looked at the ones that really fuel the supply of teachers of color. So we looked at obstacles a little bit at the college level. We also looked at the teacher preparation level, looked at some barriers there. And then finally, we looked at barriers in the school district and school arena. So kind of starting at the college enrollment completion level, really what we focused on was what is fundamentally making it hard for students of color to succeed in college enrollment and college completion. And we focus kind of on the culture on a college campus. Higher education institutions they have an institutional culture that if you're a first generation student or a student whose family members, didn't go, or, you know, if you grew up in a place where a lot of people didn't go to college, the culture on that campus is hard to navigate. It's difficult. It can be hard to navigate the student or the financial aid system. People can feel like isolated, so that if they're not there with people of their own background, they can feel like they don't belong. So that theme kind of carries through into the next two levels. And that's mainly where we focus at the teacher prep level. That tends to be on a college campus, not always, but there are alternative pathways into teaching, but still the vast majority of people come through a four-year institution. And that's difficult for a lot of people. There are financial barriers to teacher preparation. It's expensive. And the financial aid and scholarships that are available are hard to find and limited.
Could we pause there?
Yeah.
You mentioned that Wisconsin has this minority teacher loan program, which is supposed to do exactly what you're saying in terms of reducing the financial barriers for prospective teachers of color in Wisconsin. But in 2017, only one person received a loan through that program. So that's an example of, even if you have the programs in place, you need to actually make sure they're reaching people.
Yeah, and you picked up on a good point. So, having a program in place is a really good first step, but you have to give it enough resources to have an impact. People don't even know about it. In fact, several people I interviewed didn't even know that program existed. So that's an example of, different ways that barriers can come up despite good things being in place. Another aspect of barriers when you're in a training phase is some of the tests that we use in Wisconsin to sort of admit people into the profession. If you look at the pass rates on those, you'll see that there's a pretty systematic disparity by race. And so there's something going on there that's screening out students of color. And then the last area, the last sort of area on the pipeline that we looked at is in the schools and districts. So a big part of the problem with diversity in the teacher workforce is retention. It's the pipeline coming in, but it's also largely how early teachers of color leave the profession compared to white teachers. There's a difference there, and the question is why. And some of the things that we found was, one, compensation is relatively low in the teaching profession compared to other professions that require the same amount of education. Another thing that was interesting that people talked about was their own negative experiences during their K-12 years. You know, so most likely in growing up, their teacher was white because that's just the way the teacher workforce has been. And so students of color reported just feeling like they had some very negative experiences during their K-12 years, and that deterred them from entering or staying in the profession. Other things people talked about, the sort of procedural and structural, same as what we found on a college campus. People talked about the workplace didn't feel like it was welcoming, you know, because of how diversity is so limited in Wisconsin. Many teachers, wherever they are, may be the only or one of very few teachers of color in their whole faculty. And so they feel really isolated, and sometimes they feel even kind of aggression, you know, like racially motivated aggression. Maybe it's not intended, but it's certainly felt. And if they don't have a cohort that they can connect with to sort of work through navigating in a white institution, or if they don't have a principal or a mentor from their same race or ethnic background, that can deter them or make it hard for them to want to stay. And then some of them also talked about they can get pigeonholed. If they're like the one teacher of color in a class, and it might be a diverse school, so they may be the one teacher that the students can relate to from a race or ethnic background. And many of them reported sort of being pigeonholed into like the disciplinarian role. So that kind of gives you a sense of the gamut in terms of barriers that we found.
Yeah, so there are a lot of potential barriers. I mean, starting with a student's own experience in the K-12 system, maybe not seeing examples of teachers of color or having negative experiences with white teachers, then the college level, the financial barriers of getting into college and completing college, and then once they get into the workplace, having to deal with some of the issues that they might experience there in terms of not having enough support. So where do you start when you look at solutions? Like, which piece of that pipeline do you think is most important, or maybe the easiest for the state to focus on?
One really promising way to approach this is to take a grow your own approach. There is a group of educators in Wisconsin that is much more diverse than teachers, and that is educational assistants or paraprofessionals. These are basically, think of them as teacher aides. This group of people is way more racially and ethnically diverse. And it's a group of people that tends to be from the community where the school is located, and is really kind of dedicated. And a lot of them would love to become teachers, but they don't have a bachelor's degree, and they don't get paid very much. They're not in a position to really change course. And so these Grow Your Own programs that target this group of teachers provides financial support, and then it provides support for them in the classroom, allows them to use the school in the classroom where they already work to do their, you know, practical requirements. And it provides all this support around them, because this is like a non-traditional student. This is not a student that necessarily went to college right after, didn't go to college yet, maybe at all. And so helps them get their bachelor's degree, get their teacher certificate, and gives them kind of much more hands-on support with mentoring and coaching through the beginning, sort of those critical years of a teacher's career where they're most likely to leave, especially teachers of color. But there's some data to show that if you can get teachers, especially teachers of color, to get past the 3-year mark, they're way less likely to leave the profession even than some white teachers. So these Grow Your Own programs, and sometimes they take an even more intensive approach called a teacher residency, where they'll actually place a teacher in training, kind of like a doctor gets placed as a resident. They're already a doctor, but they're getting
tons of training and support for like a full year in a classroom before they're finished. And these are expensive programs because they're very intensive in terms of the support they provide. But the impact on creating high quality teachers and the retention that these teachers have is way better than baseline that's been found in other places. And so the state could play a big role in funding those programs. In California, they really looked at teacher residencies as one of their tickets to really addressing their teacher workforce problems. And they've invested millions of dollars in teacher residencies.
I do want to note that one takeaway that I had from reading this report was when it comes to solutions, there are a lot of different strategies that are being tried, but it's really piecemeal and it's like right. District by district. So there was a line in there about each community fending for itself to right. try to fix this problem if they are trying to fix it. Right. I thought that was interesting. How can the state potentially do something that's more broad and reaches more districts instead of right. just leaving it up to individual districts.
Right. The states has a role, a really big opportunity to convene the leaders, you know, throughout the education system in Wisconsin, you know, set teacher diversity as a top education priority, you know, come together and you know, establish a vision for what we think we want to accomplish here, set some concrete goals that we can measure ourselves against, and then line up the local efforts around that statewide vision. Like, let the state take a lead on this and let the local efforts plug into that. And the local people we've talked to have said, this is what we need.
Ann Chapman is a senior researcher at the Wisconsin Policy Forum. She spoke with WUWM's Emily Files about her new report studying Wisconsin's teacher diversity. Next week, Emily will host a roundtable discussion with teachers whose experiences inform the Policy Forum's research. You'll hear some of that conversation next week on Like Effect. The unemployment rate among women jumped by more than 12% between February and April of last year as the pandemic took hold. But Joan Marie Luciano Vargas saw the pandemic as an opportunity. She started her own business, and today she is the owner of Jomalu, a brand of beauty products, hair, and fashion accessories in Milwaukee. WUWM's Angelina Moshe Salazar spoke with Luciano Vargas about how she transformed the COVID-19 crisis into opportunity as a part of the COVID Earner series. Luciano Vargas begins by describing what life was like for her early on in the pandemic.
It was a very difficult time. My husband is a lieutenant at the correctional office, so I couldn't just hug my husband as soon as he came from work. There was a whole procedure that my whole household had to prepare for before he could enter our home. He would get out of work. He would wash his hands. He would change his shoes outside of the car and put them inside of a bag. And then when he got inside the car, he had his sneakers on. So then he would drive home. He would go home and he would go down the stairs to the basement where I had prepared an area for him. His uniforms were all down there, a tray for him to put his shoes in, and also mm-hmm. the Lysol disinfecting spray. Everything was down there in the basement for him. So through the side door, he wouldn't even come in. He would just go straight down so that he can take off his uniform, take off his shoes in the tray, spray them down with the sanitizer, wash his hands, wash his face, like literally just strip down in the basement and then run upstairs to the bathroom so that he can shower. Because, I mean, it sounds really crazy and bizarre right now and super extra when we talk about it right now, but we didn't know what was happening. And that was what we were told to do and advised to do, to be so careful and so cautious to make sure that if this virus got on him, that it wouldn't spread to any of us.
Months or some time passes into the pandemic and you pivot. You make a change in your life. Tell me about that change.
The change came just in a snap of a finger. It wasn't something that I was planning. It wasn't something that I had in the back of my head to do, but rather it came out of a moment of just being at home and having absolutely nothing else to do. It just felt numb. It felt like nothingness. And it was at that moment that it was just numb and nothingness that I started to pick up on things that I used to do that I had just stopped doing and forgotten about. I used to sew because of necessity, because when I was smaller in Puerto Rico, you have to sew your own uniforms. And when it came to my jewelry, it was also things that I would make for myself or for my family or for my friends. And it's different. It's quirky. But I just started to make more things. And I'm like, okay, I'm just making all these things because right now I have all this time in my hands. And this is something that I actually just love and enjoy. And I'm able to immerse myself in it.
At what point did you decide, I'm going to make this a business?
My husband was like, well, it looks like you're about ready to start a business, aren't you? And he said it jokingly, and it snapped. And literally the next week, I made a Facebook page, a closed Facebook group, and I started adding my friends, and my friends added friends, and then more friends, and then it just grew. I still can't believe it. I still can't believe the amount of support from absolute strangers. I can't believe that I was able to start a business in the middle of a year that could have been the very worst year for me.
Tell me everything about your current business.
Well, I right now make different accessories by hand. Most of them are made out of wood, and they are all hand-carved, hand-sanded, and hand-painted with different styles, different colors, different shapes, and designs that I come up with. I also make headbands, face masks, turbans, and now I am just beginning to make beauty items as well, like my very own eyelashes that I put together hair by hair. I make eyelash serums and eyebrow serums to help the growth of your hair. I'm also working on a serum for your face and my bomb lip glosses. Everything is vegan and natural and organic and raw. So there isn't any VersaGel in here or any plastic components in the lip glosses. It is created by different oils and different balms that I put together, along with fragrances and scents and flavors that are all natural and good and nourishing for you and your lips. And you're going to be popping.
What does the future hold for you?
I truly don't know. I used to be the kind of person that wouldn't take a step until I have completely and thoroughly planned out what I was going to do. I liked margins and I liked discipline. That is the way that I used to live my life with. Because if you're a mom with three kids, you need to have margins and you need to have discipline and you need to have order in order for your household to be able to work and for all your plans to be able to come true. But after a whole year where there was just uncertainty, I have been able to embrace impromptu so well that right now I am just asking God for direction and letting Him guide the way. It has been much better than any plan that I could have come up with myself. The plan was for me to return back to my job once my son went to K-3, but his birthday was cut off in the midst of all of this, so he never ended up going to school. And I was able to embrace having him here with me one more year. So when it comes to the future, I am just embracing whatever comes my way with arms wide open.
Joan Marie Luciana Vargas is the owner and founder of Jomalu, a brand of beauty products, hair, and fashion accessories operating here in Milwaukee. She spoke to WUWM's Angelina Mosher Salazar about how she was able to start her business during the pandemic as a part of our COVID Earner series. To learn more stories about how business owners of color have managed through the pandemic, visit WUWM.com. Coming up in about 15 minutes, we explore the importance of women in the music scene and look ahead to an event focused on that as a part of River West Femme Fest. But first, a new documentary tells the stories of the women of Standing Rock who continue to fight against the Dakota Access Pipeline.
It was women who were running the food tents, who were running the medical, and they were just so calm in the face of such adversity.
That's coming up on Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. Listening to Lake Effect on 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. It's been almost 5 years since the people of Standing Rock set up camp to protect their land from construction of the Dakota Access Pipeline. But their fight continues in the courts. That fight to protect their land, water, ancient burial, and prayer sites has been led from the beginning by women. The stories of those women are the focus of a new documentary film, End of the Line, which is part of Milwaukee Film's Women's History Month programming. Shannon Kring is the director of the film. She's from northern Wisconsin, but her filmmaking has taken her all over the world, including to Honduras, where she was when she heard about the protests at Standing Rock. Within 2 days of hearing of the protests, she hopped on a plane, started a crowdfunding campaign, hired a film crew, and started filming. Lake Effect's Ben Benversi spoke with Kring about the documentary and how she came to focus on the women of the movement.
Once I got to Standing Rock, I realized after 1 day of shooting that it was actually women who were running everything. And I didn't understand that women were the backbone of the Standing Rock movement. And I was told that that was because women are the ones who are the guardians and the protectors of the water. And it's their duty to be the ones to lead the charge. And so it was only after that first day of filming that I realized that this would be a story of just the women.
Hmm. You start the movie with setting up the camp, and you can see how quickly it goes from a small little entity to, you know, thousands and thousands of people. Can you talk a little bit about the role of women in organizing the resistance and leading the camps?
Well, as LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, one of the leaders, says in the film, she didn't plan on this. She didn't have a strategy for this. She was thrown into it. And so it was really at its core, at the beginning, was just five women who set up their own little camp on the shores of the Cannonball River. And they ended up issuing a call on Facebook asking for help. And so people came from around the world. When I arrived, there were between 1,500 and 2,000 people there. And that quickly grew to about 14,000 within my first two solid shoot periods. And the women were the ones who were standing in front of the fire. There was a central sacred fire in the middle where people would make announcements and give talks and such. And it was the women. It was Phyllis Young and LaDonna and other women who would give the talks, who would mobilize the people, tell people where different actions were taking place. It was women who were running the food tents, who were running the medical, and they were just so calm in the face of such adversity. And that to me was the most inspiring and, quite frankly, shocking things to me, because most people just would have crumbled in the face of that. And to me, it seemed as if the more resistance there was, the more violence there was, the stronger these women would get. Some of the women, like Phyllis Young, like Madonna Thunderhawk, these are women who have been active since the 60s in rights for American Indians and for women. And so they were used to this. And as a people, the indigenous people of this country are certainly used to, you know, standing up against the government when things like this happen, which is sadly quite often.
So this documentary is definitely part of a larger story, and it incorporates that long history of abuse and genocide. How did you place this movement into the history of Native women resisting and protecting their people against the forces of colonialism and violence? Where does Standing Rock fit into that history?
Standing Rock was one in a long line of issues such as this that happened. And in order to figure out why these women remained so calm, why they were so strong and resilient. I wanted to look at what they had gone through throughout their own personal histories and the history of their people. So we touch on in the film really searing testimony of the Indian boarding school and foster home atrocities. There's this shocking record of forced sterilization programs. We interviewed women who were sterilized and men. People don't realize that was happening pretty recently. The women of Standing Rock and Indigenous women in this country in general, they have a belief that whatever you do to Mother Earth, you do to the woman. Whatever you do to women, you do to Mother Earth. And so they talked a lot about the parallels between harming Mother Earth and the abuses that they themselves have suffered. And I have to say, I saw it through these protests time and time again.
Yeah. So through the lens of the film, how did your understanding evolve of what it actually meant to conceive of the land as, you know, a being that needed to be protected and the connection of that to women?
One of the very first interviews I did on my first day out at Standing Rock was with a young activist in her 20s named Skye Roosevelt Morris. And Skye explained to me that to them, the digging of the pipeline itself is like taking out the entrails of your mother. And that gave me quite a visual, and I understood instantly why they were so emotional. In addition to that, they were literally digging up bodies, the pipeline construction. They desecrated ancient burial and prayer sites. And so that was the first thing that really got attention in the media, that they were actually exhuming bodies. And they were some of the leaders, historical leaders of the people who were leading the protests.
Yeah. So your film starts at the Standing Rock Reservation, but it follows the story of these women well beyond the geographical confines of the camp. How did you follow them and this story as it left the bounds of Standing Rock?
So we ended up shooting with the women for more than 2.5 years because it was just as important and interesting for me to see what happened to their lives after this. You know, everybody else just packed up and went home and went on with their lives. A lot of reporters, I don't know, they just didn't seem to keep in touch with the story. And I thought that's where so much of the meat of the story is, because the women went on to go to the UN in Geneva, to go to the UN in New York and speak, to go around in their divestment tour all around the world. So what they did is they went around to governments and national banks and other institutions and talked to the organizations that were investing in fossil fuel projects, including the pipeline that they were fighting, and explained to them the violations that took place, to explain that there was never any thorough environmental impact study, as is required by law, to take place before there is any digging like this, to explain that graves were desecrated, to explain that people were abused, women were abused. I witnessed that myself out there by law enforcement, and all of the gross things that were happening out there. They took to the streets and explained that to people, and they were exhausted by that point, as you can imagine. And yet they still did it. Their divestment efforts have been very effective. We give a stat at the end of the film that they are part of a growing global coalition that has gotten more than $11 trillion now divested. They got entire governments to stop backing pipelines, for instance, such as Norway was their first big win. And they're still doing this work now.
And what is the status of the Dakota Access Pipeline that they were fighting against?
So to explain where things are, people ask us, well, is oil flowing through the pipeline? Yes, oil is flowing now. One of the first acts of the Trump administration on January 24th of 2017 was that he signed to allow the construction of the pipeline. And so it was pushed through very quickly. A federal judge ruled to shut it down on July 6th of 2020 and said, look, you do have to complete this review. And then that was reversed. On January 26th of this year, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit issued a ruling that upheld the federal court's original decision that the Army Corps did violate environmental laws and said we need a full environmental impact statement. And so most recently, just a few weeks ago, there was a group of letters from 14 tribal nations, high-profile creatives and advocates, and more than 75 Indigenous women leaders from across the U.S. They wrote to the Biden-Harris administration calling to shut down the pipeline while the review is conducted. So far, that's not been done. The pipeline is transporting 570,000 barrels of hydrofracked oil per day from the Bakken region of North Dakota to Patoka, Illinois. And the tribe is still in litigation. They're not giving up. Their next hearing is actually taking place on April 9th. And so we'll see what happens.
There's a moment in the film where we see LaDonna Brave Bull Allard, who's really at the center of this movement, and you ask what she'll do if they go ahead with construction of the pipeline. And she kind of pauses and looks deeply into the camera, and you can tell that she does not want to envision that possibility, but she is prepared for it. And I'm curious, with all the pipelines and dams and other construction projects that have threatened Native peoples, land, and water, why this water protector movement at Standing Rock was the end of the line for the people there.
So LaDonna's line was, and that was such a powerful part of the film, when I said, what will you do? And she said, we will pray, we will stand in front of the bulldozers, and we will pray, and they will shoot us. And that is what happened. And LaDonna from the beginning said, I'm willing to die for this. These women were willing from the beginning. And one of our women, you see, she's permanently blinded from getting shot by law enforcement. Others were injured. Another woman lost a part of her arm. They were willing to do anything that it took. And I think that that conviction and that passion really captured the hearts of people around the world. And what made this particular protest different was, first, it was the largest gathering of Native Americans in more than 225 years. So that was a big deal. And I think that that really inspired people. And the biggest thing that made the difference was that social media was at play. And with social media, the women got to control their own narrative, which is important in terms of any action. But it's really important for Indigenous people who have been stifled, have been completely bound and gagged, essentially, from telling their own stories. But it allowed us to show the world what was happening. And at a certain point, by the end, finally, we started seeing the big journalists coming out there and covering the stories. And I think it gave a lot of inspiration, but a lot of courage to other people who are fighting issues in their own countries. We had people from the Amazon there and people from really all over the world who learned from these women how to stand up against whatever they were facing in their own countries. And they really did inspire a movement. And we've really not had that in this country in modern times from a group such as this, who really just no matter what, are going to not back down.
Wakatonka tunka shila o maki ayoyoy.
Shannon Kring is the director of End of the Line, which is available now through Milwaukee Film through the end of March. Find more information and a link to view the film on our website, wuwm.com. This week, over 2 million more people living in Wisconsin became eligible to receive a COVID-19 vaccine. People 16 and older with certain medical conditions are now eligible. People living in some Milwaukee County zip codes also became eligible this week to increase vaccine equity. Green Bay native Beth Sherwood works at Advocates Children's Hospital in Oak Lawn. She was vaccinated as part of the 1A group back in January, and she describes what getting the vaccine meant to her.
I am a child life specialist at Advocate Children's Hospital down in Oak Lawn. I got the Pfizer two-step vaccination. at our hospital was like a rollout. So it's like all direct patient care providers were basically given the opportunity to receive the vaccine. Right now, it is not mandatory at our hospital. I know that there are some different facilities throughout the US where it is mandatory. Ours is completely voluntary. But basically, we signed up, we got the first shot almost immediately after receiving the first vaccination. We got our sign up for the second one because they say that it's most effective between 21 to 28 days after receiving your first vaccination. So they try and make sure that you're in that window. Basically, we arrived, we got our vaccination, and then just because it was pretty rapidly rolled out, we did receive monitoring for 30 minutes after receiving the vaccine. So we all kind of sat in the auditorium to receive supervision, I guess, to make sure that no one would have a reaction. But then they also had like various medical professionals on hand just in case you did. So I felt pretty safe getting it in that aspect. I feel like any other vaccines I've gotten in my life, it's like you just kind of get it and you go out about your business. So as far as like feeling safe or secure about getting this one, that definitely helped check that box for me. And then the same process for the second vaccine. However, they shortened the wait time to only 15 minutes because if you did have a reaction to the first vaccine, they were recommending you not get the second vaccine. After the first vaccine, I had some arm pain at the site of injection for about a day or two. And then I was pretty generally fatigued for probably 3 or 4 days. Slight headache day 1 to 2, but outside of that, I felt pretty normal and typical after the first vaccine. After the second vaccine, I actually didn't really have too many symptoms at all. I had like a minor headache and felt a little tired the second day, but no arm pain and no other real symptoms whatsoever. I'd say it was kind of split on my child life specific team that about 50% of us had no reaction to the second vaccine, but then 50% of my colleagues had like fever, chills, headache, body aches. So I guess I'm fortunate to not have those, but I guess like that is also the question too then, is like, how is your body processing this vaccine? Is their body making more antibodies than mine, even though I didn't have as many reactions? But I mean, I had various test periods throughout my time, but it's not like I was getting tested daily or weekly or monthly to know if I'd come in contact with it at all. I did enroll in a study back in June or July, so I did have a test done for antibodies and I did not have antibodies present. So that led them to believe that I had not yet had the virus, or I had it so much earlier that my body had already rid itself of the antibodies. That's another concern too of like getting this vaccine, is like if I had already come in contact with it and had it and my antibodies had already worn out and now you're getting this vaccine that's supposed to protect you from the virus, is that also like the same kind of wasting period of like, how long is this good for, I guess? I think there was so much hype and build up and almost like the saving grace is here. Like it's here, we're gonna finally move past this. Cause especially like being a healthcare worker, we've been in the thick of this since March and it's not gone anywhere. It's not gotten better. As other businesses have started to ease back into like, oh, we're going back into meetings or we're starting our travel again. It's like, that's never been a reality that we've been able to move forward with. So while I would reflect on like, maybe I'm not the person who needs it the most, it's almost like a badge of honor of, you know, I've worked through this since March and I put myself and my family kind of at risk in many ways of exposing myself to the virus. So here we go. If this is what it takes to even take a small step in kind of getting out of the virus or helping in any small way, shape, or form, let's do it. This vaccine actually had probably more trial participants than some of the other vaccines we've received in our past. And so while it is so new, this is kind of one of the things that science and research and a lot of people have put their brains together to come up with kind of a tool to help move us forward. Because if we don't do something now, it's just going to keep on getting worse, especially as these new strains come out and different variants that may or may not be more transmittable between people. I think that this is kind of one of the least things we can do, because clearly not everyone is abiding by the social distancing, not everyone is abiding by the masking. Until we are able to kind of get to this quote unquote like herd immunity, I don't really know what our other options are. I will say there was just such a sense of joy and relief throughout the hospital the whole time that we were receiving our first set of vaccinations, and that same energy was present after receiving our second vaccinations. So I'm hopeful that that kind of energy will kind of continue to propel the rest of our communities forward throughout everyone getting vaccinated. I know it's taking a while, but hang in there. Your number will come, I promise.
Beth Sherwood is a child life specialist and UW graduate who recently received the COVID-19 vaccine. You can find other testimonials from people who have received the vaccine at WUWM.com. Coming up, we'll get a preview of a panel discussion at this year's River West FemFest. Local musician Miss Lotus Funk will talk about the importance of women in music next on Like Effect on 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR. On 89.7 WUWM. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Although women have often been the face of the music industry, it's also infamous for exploiting them. From the girl groups of the 1950s to modern pop stars, stories of abuse and unfair treatment are commonplace. And when it comes to the people in charge, managers, executives, and producers, the industry is dominated by men. But there are many organizations trying to change that. And this Thursday, a few of them are getting together for a virtual panel discussion as a part of this year's River West FemFest. The panel will be led by local musician Miss Lotus Funk. She joins Lake Effect's Joy Powers to talk about it.
When you're talking about the impact and importance of women in music, what do you mean by that? What does that mean?
It is a loaded question, I guess. You know, what is that importance and impact? I think what we're looking at and what we'll be discussing mostly is going to be the experience of women in music and some of the triumphs throughout time in spite of the obstacles, and really being able to take in just how much we've gained from women in music and look at it as a necessity as opposed to an accessory.
The music industry is one in which women have often been the dominant face, the public representation of it. But when we dig into the industry a bit more, look at the executives, the producers, the bookers, or even just the non-vocalist musicians, things look a bit different. How would you characterize the presence of women in music behind the scenes in the music industry?
It is a male-dominated field, and sometimes, you know, women are taken for granted as musicians. I know, like, worldwide musicians who are still second guessed by their skills just because they're a woman. So it's still male dominated. And it's funny to hear you say, like, women are the face of it. And it's funny how many times in the past we've seen women be just used as essentially just the face in music, you know, be it album covers or band logos or whatnot. You know, they'll just put a pretty woman on the cover, and a woman would have very little to do with the actual project. It's like sometimes women are commodified in the music industry. And as much as we like to think like, oh yeah, we're beyond that, we're still not.
Yeah, there's of course a lot of conversation about pop stars and how they've been commodified. I think we've seen a lot of that with the new conversations about Britney Spears and what the impact of conservatorship has been on her life and really her career. And I think even beyond the idea of conservatorship and those kind of ancillary issues that she's dealt with, there is this idea of women in the industry being controlled by male managers, by male bookers, in a way that ultimately takes their careers in a way that they don't necessarily feel they have the agency over. They don't necessarily feel their voices are being heard. What does that look like now? And what are organizations doing to change that?
Well, I know that's going to be one of our topics for discussion. And I purposely reached out to agencies for this talk because I really wanted to see what infrastructure we have in place now and how we can build on it as a community. Because I feel like this might be one of the cases where people see the problem and they're working on it, but there's not enough attention being brought to the people who are working on the issue. When you mentioned Britney Spears' situation, I never thought that I would be like so emotionally connected to Britney Spears, because I would see that struggle and I'm like here for her 100%. It's dumbfounding. You wouldn't believe that somebody would be able to control another person's life to that extent. And then on the other hand, I'm very much so aware of, you know, women in the industry telling their stories of how they're being told to be over-sexual or change their image or put on a certain appearance or, you know, lie about their relationship status and age, you know, all these things just to sell records. You know, it's infuriating because as a woman, I know that there is more to our story than what people think other folks want to hear, when the reality is there are so many women out here who would love to share in on each other's experiences. So it's upsetting, but I'm hopeful because I feel that there are people willing to work together to change that norm, you know, to a paradigm shift for the music industry. So I wanted to get together people who are working on it so we can talk about best practices, what they've done in the past, any programs that they might have that people can support or benefit from.
I think most women have heard stories about women being harassed or groped and assaulted at concerts in basically every place that has concerts. If they haven't heard about it, they've experienced it. How would you say Milwaukee's music scene compares to other places?
Oof. I think there are definite spaces in the Milwaukee music scene where women are supported and protected. However, I don't think that's a practice that's like wildly used throughout all of the different music scenes in Milwaukee. And I don't think it's unique to the city. I think it's just culturally, we have to get beyond that space. But I do see a practice in some Milwaukee music scenes where women are protected. And I appreciate that. And I kind of stay in those areas.
You mentioned you connect with the kind of exploitation that Britney Spears has experienced. Of course, she's not alone. A lot of prominent musicians have experienced this level of exploitation. In your career, have you felt like there has been this pull on you?
Yes and no, I guess. I wouldn't compare things that I've experienced to like situations of artists who, you know, gave their heart and soul into a whole project just to have it yanked away and claimed by another person. But I've definitely had multiple experiences, especially in my earlier time as a musician. You know, I feel like I was duped. Kind of being told like, we want you to come perform as a woman for women in this woman's showcase because we want to support women. And then you ask them, you know, like, well, how are you supporting me monetarily? And the answer is, well, it's a free show, but you know, we want to support women in the arts. And it's like, okay. So it's like, you know, I wanted to be there to support it, but then also felt duped. And I guess it was just a learning experience because I had to realize they're not doing what they're intending to do if they're asking women to perform for free in order to support women in the arts.
Yeah. Now, with this panel discussion, you're talking with some women, female-centered organizations about the importance of women in music. What are these groups and what are they doing to ensure there is a space for women in music here in Milwaukee and the Midwest?
Yeah, so we are working with folks in the Midwest and in the Milwaukee area. One of our members is Ellie Jackson. She's a part of FemFest and they do great things just to raise money for women organizations through the arts. And they're also really supportive of the arts community and women creators in Milwaukee. We're also going to be having Jessie LaBelle from Women in Music Chicago, and it's a whole international organization. We're also going to be joined with Rebecca Burrell. She is a well-renowned artist from Milwaukee. She's a musician, and she also started her own organization called Revolution Ready, and they work a lot with organizing activists and fighting against systematic racism. I'm also going to be joined with Aisha Jafar. She's done a lot of work here in Milwaukee and she's really connected to the music industry. So I'm looking forward to getting her feedback and input on all of the questions. And yeah, we're also going to be joined by Girls Rock, They also do Ladies Rock Milwaukee, and they're an organization here that just has infrastructure to encourage women to join into the arts and performance and in the background, you know, in sound engineering. So we're also going to be joined by Carmel Holt. She's a disc jockey with her own radio station devoted entirely to supporting women in music and the arts. And she runs Shiro's Radio and the Shiro's Mixtape. It's going to be a fabulous conversation, and I think it's going to be really in depth. I can't wait to get all these minds to the table, and I'm really hoping, you know, fingers crossed, that once you get people together, you know, you never know what can come of it. So I'm hoping that this could be the birth of a great new tradition or maybe a new connection, just to get people really connected to that network of folks supporting women in music.
All right. Well, Lotus, thank you so much for joining us here on Lake Effect and sharing your work.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Miss Lotus Funk is a Milwaukee-based musician, and she spoke with Lake Effect's Joy Powers. Miss Funk will be hosting a virtual panel about the importance of women in the music industry this Thursday at 6 o'clock as a part of this year's River West Femme Fest. You can find more information about the event at WUWM.com. And that wraps up the show for today. Thank you so much for being with us. I'm Audrey Nowakowski. Tomorrow on Lake Effect, we'll learn why two Milwaukee organizations, We Got This and Running Rebels, have decided to join forces to help young people in Milwaukee. Plus, we'll learn about a new project that the former host of Around the Corner with John McGivern is now working on. That's tomorrow at 10 on Lake Effect, right here on listener-supported 89.7 WUWM, Milwaukee's NPR.